right. I am speaking with The Emasculator writer, director, editor, Susanna Kapostashi. Thank you for screening your film with us and sitting down to talk with me about it.
Sure.
Okay, to start with, I read an interview with Lunchmeat that you work in the veterinarian field and this has influenced your filmmaking. Is this true and can you elaborate?
So I've been an ER vet tech for, like a decade now. And so what happened, I guess, first off, I see like a lot of gore and guts and nasty stuff every day. Obviously different realm, but I kind of liken it to mildly like, you know, Savini went to Vietnam and he saw all this gore and guts and stuff for real. And then he came back and I am like 1% of who Tom Savini is skills wise, but it still does help. Like, I perfected my blood recipe and we have a blood bank at work. And what I did was I asked my boss if I could bring home expired blood. And this sounds kind of weird, but like I sat in my backyard for a day and I mixed my blood. And then I like looked at the real blood and I splattered it against different things. I put it on my skin to see how it dried to like really like get it right. Cause I know some people like the 70s Argento and Dawn of the Dead blood. That's totally off. But I see it so much. Like I need that shade of brown. I need it to dry right. It's going to bother me if it's too bright, or I can't stand when it's like on white fabric and it turns pink. So that's one example. But the one that ties to the emasculator is I got licensed as a vet tech, I don't know, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, something. And I was in school and my last thing was an externship at like a large animal, like a farm type place. And she brings out this freaking emasculator and she just goes on to talk about, you know, its function, the process, and about how you can potentially cut too high. And if the animal has like a pre-existing hernia or something, you can just eviscerate it, meaning like all of its guts just totally spill out. Now, the real life process is generally bloodless because it's supposed to clamp and then cut below that. But what she explained was if you flip it around and it cuts and then clamps, it's going to be real bloody. And again, you have a potential evisceration if it's the right circumstances. Now, the emasculator was just a crimping one, which is why we kind of added the Vietnam knife. And, you know, we took a lot of cinematic liberties there, but, you know, we get the point across. It's a farm tool. It does bad things.
Absolutely. Wow. That was an amazing answer. Thank you. Brad, I love that story of you hit blood, testing the blood, getting it perfect. And your blood looks great. It does not look
yeah, thank you.
Bright red 70 shit. Yeah. All right. My next question is, you kind of mentioned this bit in your intro. The Emasculator is a rape revenge movie and it follows a lot of the classic tropes of the genre, but it also subverts a lot of them, or at least a few of them. How do you see your film in the lineage of like rape revenge cinema?
I don't know, because like it's hard to compare to all of my favorite movies. That it's, as a shot on video movie maker and as someone that like has a real job, I'm never going to make a movie as good as Lipstick or as good as The Accused or as good as Miss 45. So I guess I don't know if it falls into that lineage, because it's just never going to be that good. I just kind of try my best. But I did pull a lot from those movies. The way I shot the rape scene, I watched The Accused a couple of times to kind of get the framing, because it's, again, it's generally just me with the camera. Sometimes I'll have Tim with me, but in general, it's just me, the camera, directing the effects, the lighting, everything. So I did learn a lot from those movies, especially with shot sequences, especially with tropes, but I don't know that I fall in the lineage, because I don't know that my movie is nearly as good as any of those. Maybe Donald Farmer's Savage Vengeance. Maybe I fall into that lineage.
Well, I would just say I think your movie's awesome. So
thank you.
So I think it falls in the lineage. And also Donald Farmer, Abel Ferreira, we should be able to talk about them in the same breath, you know?
It's hard to, I mean, Abel Ferrara is pretty, he's pretty incredible. It's hard to.
I understand.
Yeah. And I think that's good. I don't want to be better than my heroes, you know, like there are heroes for a reason. They're incredible. What's the point if you reach that peak? It's just not possible, I don't think. And that's okay.
It's like you always have something to strive towards, right? Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to be better than Roger Watkins. Yeah, I get that.
Yeah, and it's just he's a certain personality. Like you're just, I don't know. Times have changed, and it's just, especially without film, like video to me is the next best thing, but like it's really hard to get that look and that feel and the time. Like a movie made in the 2020s is not going to look like a movie made in the 1970s. The costumes, the people, the environment. And sure, I try, but it's just not the same. It's like we're all constantly trying to capture this era that doesn't exist anymore.
Okay, so that's interesting what you're saying there, like because you make Shaun of the Dead movies, and they are, at least the two I've seen, they are working in like familiar kind of, I guess, genre frameworks, right? But they also do feel like you're doing something new with them. But there's this tension between what you're saying there, between like making the new stuff but also kind of trying to recreate this thing that can't be recreated. Like, is that what draws you to shooting on tape in the first place? But you just suggested actually that you maybe would rather shoot on film if you could.
I do like tape. I do like it a lot. Nothing's ever going to beat film, but let's face it, it's just me. I don't have a lot of money. And even modern film stock doesn't look like old film stock. So I think like 2020s me, I'm still going to choose video because I can shoot on the same exact cameras and they are going to look exactly like the movie I'm trying to emulate. But like if you look at newer stuff that's shot on film, I can't tell the difference quite as much as I'd like to. You know, you can put a lot and do a little grade and a little overlay with film grain. And I don't have that talent of the eye to tell a huge difference with modern film, whereas video, you can get the same exact cameras. I shot Night of the Zodiac on the same camera I shot that Tim shot Creep on. So, and it looks exactly the same where film stock, I think you're not going to get that 70s film stock. You're not going to get that color look. You're not going to get that softness anymore. So, I guess if I could go back in time, I would shoot on film and I would probably be one of those snobs that's like, why are you shooting on video? But in 2020, I love the softness of video. I love all the creative stuff you can do with glitching and mixing and circuit bending and all that weird stuff. If that answer
When you say
made
circuit
sense.
bending, can you elaborate on circuit bending?
Yeah, and it's something I admittedly need to learn more about. I've bought like pre-made things where you can basically plug in the video signal and distort it. And a lot of the glitching and stuff you see in the emasculator is from that. I'm trying to learn basic electronics and circuit boards and stuff so I can do my own thing, but we'll get there maybe for the next one. But that's where all of the weird stuff in the emasculator came from. I mixed like a bunch of different stuff. I was like a mad scientist. I had like a couple different circuit bending glitcher things, which is literally like you plug your RCA cables, you've got like a knob and you mess with it and it just mixes two signals and clashes and it's completely impossible to control. But then I ran that through a color mixing board and was just kind of, I was kind of like the dude in Phantom of the Paradise, like reaching for all the stuff. And it was fun, but so that's also difficult because when you're trying to capture video directly, the second that you're, the second you reach that digital interface and the analog gets glitchy, it just blue screens. So it's a whole uncontrolled madness. And I do have a time-based corrector, which helps significantly, but when you're like just bending the hell out of the signal and pressing a million switches like a caveman. Like you're gonna lose a signal because you're doing a lot. So that was really fun with like the Vietnam footage and the rape footage and mixing the two. And then I kind of like mix the audio under it to make it work. And I definitely am gonna keep doing that with my movies. I don't wanna like repeat it and do the same exact thing, but I think especially as I learn and like harness more control over it, it's something that I think adds a lot. And not only that, but it's really fun to work with.
Well, and it's rad in the movie. I love the way those the Vietnam flashback kind of overlaid over the rape scenes, squiggling over each other. I love the way it looked. And I loved in the actual rape scene, the glitches in that scene. I thought it particularly were very memorable, and the way the tape would just kind of like come over itself.
Yeah, I was really happy with how that turned out. And I did do a lot of editing where I would capture stuff separately and then like more controlled setting overlay the glitches where I wanted them.
Oh,
again,
cool.
because it's just so chaotic that, if I were to do it all in one take, there's no way. It would blue screen half the time, and you're controlling and not controlling a lot of things at the same time. It's pretty wild.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty interesting because I would think when you're shooting on tape, like you have like a limited number of tapes and there's not that much room to kind of experiment as you're talking about. But I love to hear that you're going hog wild with it. That's awesome.
Yeah, well, my capture process is kind of wonky, and it's because my brain is kind of wonky, and I can't stand compression artifacts. So, like, and this is not a criticism to the way people do things, but most people will capture on tape and then use like this little USB dongle thing that is, it's basically for grandmas that want to, capture home movies, and they don't care because they're just watching it on their TV, and there's their grandkids and whatever. But everything that I love about video, the softness, the grain, it gets crushed if you don't capture it correctly. And then instead of kind of the organic noise and artifact, you're getting these weird, ugly little squares and this macro blocking. And once I saw it, I couldn't stand it. So when I capture my footage, and this was new with the emasculator, I capture directly from the camera. And I back it up on tape, and then I capture the tapes with a time-based corrector. So I do back myself up, and that's a whole pain in the ass because you've got sometimes cameras from like the early 80s, and the audio doesn't quite want to get along, and you're converting a whole lot of things all at once to try to get it through that digital gateway. And then your rig ends up weighing like 30 pounds, and you've got a million cords. And if you've like set up one thing wrong, you're not going to get a signal. It's a little bit of a process, but I think it's worth it because I can't stand that. If you're going to shoot on video, it needs to look like video. That's like shooting on 16 millimeter and then just like putting it on a tape. All that information is going to get compressed and just not have that look that I want.
And are you recording audio through the cameras as well, or are you recording audio separately?
So through the monitor, I use Blackmagic Video Assist, and the giant 7-inch monitor that's a huge pain in the ass to work with has separate XLR inputs. So it makes a pretty heavy rig, but and then one of the mini DV cameras I shoot on a lot has an SDI output, and so in that case it just goes directly. It's the going from analog to SDI that you have to do the audio separate, and it's worth it, but it's certainly a challenge.
So you clearly know a ton. You're clearly like deep in the tech sauce. Like, how did you can you can you get a kind of a classic question? Can you give me a bit of your filmmaking origins? Like, how did you get into like recreating these rigs, making this stuff on your own and going so deep into the zone?
I think I just have a sticky brain. So definitely the like capture process was new as of a couple of years ago, I guess, when I was just getting into the emasculator. And it was just because I noticed the artifact and I didn't like it. And I was also capturing Tim Ritter's stuff for SRS, and we learned a lot there. And obviously that's like holy footage, so I didn't want to mess that up. And so that's when I started to learn about time-based correctors and correct capture process and using the right codec and all of that stuff. And I guess it just kind of translated into my work after we got all of his stuff ingested and looking as best as it could.
Cool.
But before that, I went to video school, which was useless. And then I just always made movies on my own.
Why was video school useless?
Because all the professors basically had gone to video school and couldn't find a job and became professors. Everyone I went to school with wanted to be a director, but didn't watch movies. I did not want to be a director. I went to college because my mom made me go to college, essentially. And I was like, well, if I'm going to have to be here, I'll do video stuff. And it was real annoying because it was electronic media production. It wasn't like film school. So it should have been a little versatile, but it was definitely like painstaking to be in like screenplay class, and the teacher's like, okay, I'm going to pick a movie everyone's seen, Jaws. And it's like dead silent. Or Oliver Stone visited campus and nobody in my program gave a shit. It was awesome. I got to meet him. I got in a little bit of an argument with him very briefly.
Awesome. Well,
So I worked teleproductions, and so I was just running camera for this big dumb political thing he was speaking about. And my boss, through the headset when it's over, just said, "Susanna, just go find him," and made someone else put my stuff away. And I went up and I introduced myself. And let's see, I was probably 19, maybe a little younger, and I had just started getting into Sam Fuller. So I asked him if the steel helmet was a big influence on Platoon. And he said, "Sam Fuller, that's just kid stuff." And I kind of argued with him a little bit, but then as I was walking away, he said, "Watch Men in War." And that was a pretty cool movie. So it was nice to have, like, a couple words.
That's
And
awesome.
again, none of my classmates were there. Nobody cared, but I cared. I thought it was cool.
That was cool. That's I went to film school and I teach in film school and it's the
Oh,
same,
nice.
unfortunately.
Oh, really? Even in film school?
Oh,
Like,
it's it might even be worse. I remember when I first went to film school and I was like, finally, all my fellow movie heads, and they were like, you nerd.
yeah, it's weird. Like, I was shooting Metal Maniac, and they were just like, I don't know, going to parties and looking on Facebook or whatever it is that people were doing in 2012. It was very strange. I think all of them are like failed realtors now. Like, you get a useless major and then you get a useless job. I shouldn't talk. I'm a vet tech, but eh.
But you're also making movies.
Yeah. I mean, I was then. Nothing's really changed. I had a few good professors. I shouldn't say that it was a complete waste, but there were
Yeah.
like two in a sea of just, people.
Yeah, no, I understand. There's definitely, I'm like the professor who knows about film at the film school, you know? And it's like definitely like
Yeah.
I sometimes been like, let's watch this, we'll show this, and they're like, that's really obscure. And I'm like, no, it's not.
Yeah, I had one. My screenwriting professor was like that. He liked like old film noir stuff. So he was always like, he recommended the Yakuza was probably one of the ones that he recommended that I immediately fell in love with. And I could totally email him and be like, "Hey, I stayed up watching movies. I'm not coming to class." And he'd be like, "Fine.
Yeah,
At least you're watching
you
movies."
get it. You're learning, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I like that guy.
Have you seen the movie? Have you seen Blonde Death?
Not yet. I started it and like it didn't grab me as much because I'm reading like John Waters vibe, shot on video, all this stuff, and I need to try it again because it did not sit with me. I must have been in the wrong mood. I think I was also watching a crappy online rip before it got out on Blu-ray, and so it was again compressed and macro blocked all to hell. So I need to give it another shot because I on paper it's everything I like, but I just could not get into it.
Well, it's like it is like again, it is like very like kind of plain. It's not very like a grabby thing, you know. I feel like it could definitely in the not in the right zone for it. I only bring it up because I showed it to my class last year to the people who stuck around for it. And I was like, no one else is showing you a movie that costs $2,000. All right. That's only here.
Did they like it?
Yeah, the ones who stayed liked it. They were it was kind of a small group of students who stuck around for it, but it was I would say seven watched it and probably two found it completely baffling and were like, just never seen a movie like that at all. You probably never seen a movie that cost less than like $10 million or something. So, but the
Oh,
ones
yeah.
who dug it, they were like, this is one of the funniest movies I've ever seen. It's crazy. So there's still hope.
Everyone I went to school was with re was really into like Marvel movies.
Yeah.
And there was this one kid, and his only contribution to any screenwriting discussion was the Avengers eating shawarma, which I don't know exactly what he's talking about, but like he got real excited about it every time.
Oh man, film school. Yeah, mamma mia.
Kids, man, kids.
Kids. Yeah, that's how it goes. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Back to the emasculator.
Yeah.
I have two questions. I'm gonna kind of bets around. So one, okay, we've talked a bit about movies, and you're obviously a huge movie head. First of all, I want to ask you, like, you specifically seem to be drawn to stuff that I also like, which is like 70s and 80s exploitation and shot on video stuff and vintage porn. And so, first of all, can you talk about like maybe why you're drawn to these kind of movies in general? And then, can you talk about, I guess, maybe some further specific influences on the emasculator if you want to pull some out?
I think what I love the most about vintage porn is it's movies made by people, not necessarily directors, not necessarily a Hollywood system. Like I've been digging into some like Arthur Bresson Jr. stuff lately, and it's so I'm a straight woman. I have no business watching gay porn, but you look on Letterboxd reviews and there's a bunch of people like there's a bunch of straight dudes, watching Forbidden Letters and being like, "Oh my God, this is brilliant." And I think the fact that it's just a dude that had to make a movie and had to raise the money himself, and it's just so much all him, is what makes it special, you know? So I think that's the big thing, is it's, you know, movies made by a person rather than a director and a producer and a studio and somebody calling the shots. Like Ty West is a really good example of movies not made by a person. I have a feeling maybe there's a 50-50 chance that like he actually is like us and likes really cool stuff, and the studio is no. Okay, there's a 0% chance, because my other theory is that he watches Pornhub and not like he doesn't have like a Blu-ray collection of like golden age porn.
You know, that's interesting. I don't love Ty West. I thought X, when they were making the porn, I was like, that looks like porn I've seen from the 70s. I thought he kind of got the.
Oh, really? I thought X looked like Pornhub. There were no angles, there was no lighting. It was just like, what was it, like a milkman? No, it was a guy that was lost going to the house. No.
It's like Farmer's Daughter vibe. I remember seeing it. I remember thinking it did look like Nine Lives of a Wet Pussy. I thought like that's the kind of maybe I'm just the easy mark in the cinema. I was just like, ooh, it's soft.
He
It's
did have a nice filter on it.
a nice filter. That's I was like starved. I was like, ooh, they're talking about vintage porn in a mainstream movie. I'm
No, I was
the
excited, and then I was like, ah, this guy watches Pornhub. This guy is not, yeah.
It's not true. I did see he did release like his like Sight and Sound top 10, and it was like the most it was like Googling most famous movies core stuff. So yeah, I don't think
He
he's
kind of seems like that guy, and I'm not like, I guess I sound like a mean person right now, but he kind of seems like that guy that like you talk about something cool and he immediately looks at his phone to look it up and then just like says just the right things, but he doesn't really know. You know, like he reads like the Wikipedia article on it for the cool points, but then like isn't gonna get like real passionate about it, you know? He's not gonna like go nuts on how like the opening of Misty Beethoven is the greatest like romantic comedy of all time, which it is. I mean, it's fantastic.
great movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, has he seen that scene in Barbara Broadcast where C.G. Lang pees in the kitchen? I don't think so.
I love that scene.
It's an amazing scene, right? Yeah, I love that scene. Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with your Ty West hate, even though I kind of like some of his movies. I still hate him a little
Yeah, Maxine. Maxine came out on the same day as The Emasculator.
Really? My partner saw Maxine and she was like, nah, bad. I was like, cool,
Yeah,
I'm watch it.
it was two Stranger Thingies like hinging on nostalgia rather than actually feeling it.
Okay, that
And
okay.
like showing the title card from behind the green door really bothered me, because like, you know, the super iconic scene in there is not even that hardcore. You could have very easily cut that with Johnny Keyes and Marilyn Chambers, and you could have cut that and made it soft core. It is practically soft core. Why are you showing the title card? You're showing the title card because you're on Wikipedia being like, oh, I know about the 70s porno, but you don't know that it was like, you know, one of the first big commercial significant interracial scenes and all of the everything before that. You don't know that they fucked for like 10 hours before shooting that scene, and the chemistry was like incredible. Like, those are the things that you should know if you're going to make reference. I'm no film scholar. I know little bits here and there. Like, I really don't know as much as I'd like to, but I at least like stuff, like genuinely like stuff, rather than just Wikipedia article it, you know?
You said a second ago this idea of like, I don't remember the exact phrasing, but it was kind of like homaging or like pastiching versus like embodying. That's kind of like the distinction.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it.
Your work, I really do feel like embodies the spirit of the stuff you're playing with, but that's also what makes it feel like in the moment, like current to me as well, right? Because it's not you're
Yeah.
not playing dress up. You are like, you understand what you're working with, and you're channeling that into the now.
Well, stuff I'm just excited about, you know, like Russ in The Emasculator is 100% just me, you know, the porn director that's constantly being like, oh, well, Phil Prince used this in his soundtrack. You know, that's, I have a hard time like keeping that contained when I'm even out with normal people sometimes. It's just,
Yeah, me
I'm
too.
excited about it. It just kind of spews out sometimes.
And it's interesting that in The Emasculator and also in Night of the Zodiac, the characters who are so into this and talk about this kind of film zone we're talking about, they're also like all depraved sickos. I think that's a really interesting kind of
Yeah.
movies. It's like you're like almost like a stand-in for you, and it's like that's the most fucked up person in the movie. Can you talk about that a bit? Is that like a thing you're intentionally playing with that just come
A
out?
little bit. I will admit, Night of the Zodiac was a little bit two-dimensional on paper, and the actor, Phil, added quite a bit to that character. So I've got to credit him for all of that. I was just super excited about shot on video movies and wanted to do a tribute, and definitely any depth to that character was all Phil and his improvising and his like, hey, we need to have this scene where he realizes he's a psychopath and he's happy with it. We need to have this scene where he looks at the mirror and likes himself for the first time. You know, when he's talking to the magician and he's criticizing him, he's actually criticizing himself. Like, that was all Phil. I can't take credit for any of that. The Emasculator was definitely like writing myself and then putting like a sharpened bad edge. Like, Russ is kind of likable, but he's also an absolute degenerate that is happily watching women get raped because he doesn't see the divide between like, you know, reality and fiction. And this is the closest he can get to being like his hero. So yes, he's a terrible person. Yes, he absolutely deserves the castration that he gets, but like, I like playing with making him a little bit likable, you know, like a little tiny bit relatable.
He's
Just
got that like
it's
infectious
interesting.
creative quality. He's like so excited to, yeah.
Yeah, like his motives aren't, I want to rape women. That's just like a side effect that he's gonna ignore because he wants to be the next Phil Prince or Sean Costello or whoever, you know,
Yeah.
which is interesting and fun to write and fun to direct. And I should say that all my actors are just my friends. So like Michael, who played Russ, was like a body in Zodiac. He was the wheelchair dude with his guts spilling out and like the cipher, but this was his first time acting. And I thought he was damn convincing. Or Brad Grinter, that's his stage name because he's got like a real job and stuff, but he's my friend that I make all my movies with and is usually on the other side of the camera with me, but he just had that like Rolling Thunder look to him. So we're like, okay, this, and he's a dad and he could put a lot of his self and his own like concerns about his daughter and stuff into it. But that was his first time ever acting, and that was a super challenging role.
He's
He
awesome.
also broke the hell out of his hand in the scene where he punches the desk.
Oh, really?
Yes. And that was one of the first things we shot that day. And it was a super long day. And we just kept shooting, and his hand kept getting more and more swollen. And then he was in a cast, and we tried to hide it for the rest of the shooting, but it's just this very obvious black cast. Yeah,
Well, I did,
it was
I did not
something.
notice it. So
Good. Yeah, no, it's a couple times where there's close-ups, we had Tim like body double for his hands, like when he's cocking the BB gun.
Oh,
But yeah,
fuck.
no, he was wearing a cast for like 80% of the movie because he thought it was going to be like this shitty desk and it was like hard oak or something. And you could, and I edited that dialogue a lot. And every time like he punched it and the sound wave just, I just cringed because it was bad. It was really bad.
Very a committed performance. Well,
Yeah, it was very physical performance.
you're saying most of these people, all these people are your friends, and you were talking about directing the lead on Night of the Zodiac and like how much he was giving to it. Like, what are your sets like? Like, how do you direct performers? Are you just like, is it just a lot of trust, or are you giving specific stuff you want?
I really like improvising. So I'll write my script, I'll write the line that I want, and I'll just tell them like, say it how you would say it, or feel free to add stuff. Another really good example is my friend Adam, who played Billy. I am not nearly that funny or depraved. And Adam and I have been making movies together since we were teenagers. He's like the original Metal Maniac. He was in Johnny Braineater when we were 17. And he just kind of knows our sense of humor. Like, he wasn't supposed to be jerking off in that scene, for example. He just did it and started singing that song, and I was like, yes, this is perfect. So sometimes I'll be like, no, that doesn't work, and then I'll encourage when it's something that I really like. And I will ask for another take or two if it's not working, but generally I just cast correctly. Like, Russ, Michael, very much acts like a combination of me and himself. Like, when I did D&D, he was our DM, and he's kind of got that dorky, really excitable personality. So I cast him for that. Adam is just good at playing the gross guy that says gross, disgusting things. My buddy Jesse's just the cool black guy. Like, and that's exactly how I wrote him. And I wrote his own dialogue into it and encouraged him to like loosen it up and make it his own. So,
He looks fucking sick in those sunglasses as well.
yeah. Yeah. And that dude doesn't like movies at all. Like, his favorite movie is Shrek, not the shot on video one, but like the one with the ogre. We work together and we're buddies, but like, I just thought, like, put sunglasses on this guy and he looks like he's made for this role. And then we put those ridiculous clothes on him. And he doesn't even watch movies. And I thought he did great.
That's
I
awesome.
will say the hot tub scene was really hard to shoot because I could not stop. He looked so ridiculous. I was going for like cool dude. And then that little yellow hat made him look like the kid from It. And I just like could not. I was crumpled in a heap, like under the camera laughing for most of those takes. So.
That hot tub scene is the gore. Oh, I want to ask you about. I'm gonna ask you about the gore specifically in the hot tub scene in a second, because that castration in particular is I think seared in my mind for a very long time. I okay. I have another question about just kind of like movie kind of movies in general. I did just notice you wearing a Hot Summer in the City shirt. Is that that's the
Oh
that's
yeah.
is that the porno where the one that Tarantino likes, where all like
Yeah,
the
and so I live in Michigan in the US, and this is the first, like, I mean, I'm sure there were other like 8mm loops and stuff, but this is officially the first porno made in Michigan, and it's fascinating because it was made by college students. So I know you're like across the globe, but the Evil Dead guys, I believe, went to Michigan State University. And that is where Gail Palmer went. And she was dating a much older scuzzy dude that owned the local porn theater. And I'm kind of just basing this off the Rialto report. But I mean, again, if you don't know a lot, you go through the smarter people. But anyway, she was dating scuzzy older guy that ran the local porn theater. She got a job there, immediately like took over, turned it around, made it a classy place, for lack of better words. And he said, "Oh, I'm going to make this movie." So she had her hand in writing it, and a lot of it was based on like the Detroit race riots and things she felt about it. She rented equipment from her college. So that's the equivalent of like one of your students just like renting equipment and going off to make this super racially charged porno, no big deal. Cast students from campus, and supposedly the boyfriend was directing it. But then she gets there, nobody knows what they're doing, everybody's shy, nobody can get hard. She drives back to the theater, finds a regular, says, "Hey, can you get a hard on command?" He says, "Yes." She says, "Show me." They go into like some broom closet or something. He gets hard. She says, "Great, come with me." Drives him back to the set and just ends up directing this thing. And then they premiered it, like not on campus, but like in Lansing, Michigan, where the campus was. Advertised, this is the advertisement from the Lansing State Journal, which is a newspaper that is still just like the newspaper people read the weather and stuff out of. Like, to me, that history is so fascinating.
That's
And it's debated whether or not Gail Palmer like was actually the director, or he was just like, "Oh, it'd be cool to say that a chick directed this." But the Rialto Report article makes it pretty clear, I think. Like, all of that makes sense to me. Everybody awkwardly standing around, not knowing what to do, and someone just takes charge. Like, that sounds very familiar, film set wise, to me at least.
Yeah,
Yeah, I
absolutely.
really like Hot Summer in the City. I wish the end was more cathartic, but I mean, the history is so rich and it's so politically incorrect in every way possible.
Yeah, I gotta say it's not one of my favorites. I had a bit of trouble with that one, but the history is fascinating. As you said, it's like that's real people that
Yeah.
that's a real life that kind of
Yeah,
explodes.
and I can see it not being like a favorite, but it's hard living in Michigan and just like this was made here and the soundtrack makes it so fascinating too.
I
I
love
like I
it.
said, I just wish that there was an actual revenge plot.
Yeah.
It the whole just like walking into the sunset at the end, like, "Oh, I just went through 24 hours of hell, but it's okay now," doesn't sit well, but I still love everything else about it.
Maybe perhaps they ran out of money at the end there to
Yeah,
get
who knows?
that. Okay, so sorry, I have one more question about just movie stuff. Well, then more will come up, I'm sure. But okay, in Night of the Zodiac, there is a very funny but also dismissive joke about Tales from the Kwadad Zone. How do you feel about that movie?
I love Tales from the Quadded Zone. It's really, it warms my heart that so many reviews are like defending it.
That's,
It's
no,
like,
my, yeah.
we love Tales from, Richard, the character doesn't get it. And that's the point, is he might not necessarily be a spirit of shot on video guy. He is kind of an egomaniac. So he would not watch Tales from the Quadded Zone and see the charm. He wouldn't get it. He would just be like, ah, there's not really much of a story. This doesn't make sense. This sucks. And it also kind of goes to the joke. Brad Grinter, his girlfriend is like, she's very sweet, but she's very normal. She's not into any of the things that we're into. So we like to show her stuff. He likes to show her stuff sometimes just to see how she'll react. So he showed her that and she cried and asked him if he still loved her. So it's kind of like that movie is kind of a joke amongst our friends group because, like, he showed his girlfriend and it literally caused tears. It was, to her so bad. I think it's great.
I'm with you. I thought that it was going on, but I did when I watched it, so like I was like,
How
this is
dare
crazy.
they?
How to accept this movie is
No, we just, I mean,
crazy.
the sh 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 it's a great joke,
It's a
and
great
it
joke.
was just
It's really
me off
funny.
camera, like, waving something and doing that, which is probably how they did it too,
Oh
honestly.
yeah, I felt very seen by that. I interviewed Chester Novel Turner a few years ago. That
Oh,
was
cool.
What a delight that was. Never in a million years, I think I chat to him. He says he's making his sequel, Tales of the Quadded Zone. I hope it comes out.
Yeah, and that kind of goes back to what we started talking about, where so much of those movies is like that time and that equipment. I always, my f initial reaction when like an old director that I love is coming back is always just like, oof.
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying quality, if you know what I mean. I guess
Yeah.
I'm just like, I'm along for the ride.
I mean, I'm gonna watch it, but like the Casio keyboard and the, crappy, poorly tracked VHS were really a lot of the charm in that movie. And again, the time and the actors and the setting, like, I'm interested to see how that translates to modern world, modern equipment.
Yeah, I'd be very, yeah, may perhaps I'm hoping he can still capture that just like, we're just hanging out quality that his movies used to have.
Yeah, I mean, I'll watch it for
Yeah.
sure.
Okay, back to specifically The Emasculator. I want to ask you what we talked a bit about the lead played by Brad Grinter, who is, as I said, he's really, really great, and I think he's really good at selling like the melancholy of the movie and like how really
Yeah.
he is. He's the thousand yard stare he has is really good. But a character who's in the movie less, but is also obviously really important, is his daughter Sydney. And I thought her character was fascinating. And I thought it's the end when she reveals what's going on, like it's like a very intense twist of her archetype. And she name drops Roberta Findlay, who we talked about a bit
Yeah.
earlier. And I think definitely think her like apparent misanthropy like backs that up. Can you just talk about like the conception of that character and playing that final scene out?
So that was Tim wrote that twist. And I argued with him like a jerk. I don't even remember how I was going to end The Emasculator, but it wasn't like that. And he brought it up and I just about immediately dismissed it. And he was like, okay, I think it's a good idea, but whatever. And I kind of let it cook for a little bit and then it worked, especially because The Emasculator is admittedly accidentally kind of a feminist film. I think that twist really brings it home. Like, we think that this is the victim, but guess what? We thought all these guys were bad. Look at this.
Yeah, it's kind of like I don't know how to describe it. It has that Findlay edge of being this kind of complicated, I guess, portrayal of gender relations. Like it's not clear cut, and I think it's what makes it really interesting.
Right. Speaking of Roberta Findlay, she was supposed to have a audio cameo. The little part where like the lady from the funeral home calls and her name's Roberta. I tried to get her to do it and she was basically like, no. We did talk a little bit though. That was cool.
Oh, that's fun. So she was at least somewhat friendly to you. She wasn't just immediately just.
Yeah, she was not as dismissive as I thought because I know she's not the biggest fan of women. Yeah, I think she initially thought I was going to do an interview and I should have been like, yeah, let's talk, let's do an interview, but instead I was like, actually, I just can you please record this? And she was just like, no. And then she never responded ever again, which is fair.
This is fair. The poster I showed you earlier, the Mystique poster, I should have told you this earlier, but you'll get a kick out of it. The Okay, when Roger Rodgkins was writing it, right? It's based on a Death in Venice, the Thomas Mann novel
Okay.
that Visconti turned into a movie in the 70s, which is about like an artist who goes to the seaside and becomes obsessed with a younger woman. But at the time when they were making it, when he was writing it, Roberta was dating, I forgot his name, you probably know his name, but the guy she was with owned like
Walter Sierra, the audio dude.
the audio dude. So he owned a bunch of trombones or something, and they wanted to make, so Roberta and him were like, Roger, can you make, instead of the lead character being like a photographer, can you make her like a trombonist, or maybe a puppeteer or something like that, trumpet, some sort of horn section.
Yeah.
And it did not happen, but God, I wish it did. Wouldn't that be amazing to see a
That
porno
would be wild. Yeah. Yeah, I
where...
need to watch that. Does it have a Blu-ray release?
No, you can only find it in a really terrible copy on like Two Porn Classic.
Man, I hate that. Why is Vinegar Syndrome fucking around with all these porno comedies and all this lighthearted stuff when there is stuff like that to unearth?
Just
Like,
look
come
at it.
on.
I'm with you. It's a bummer of a movie. That the poster makes this looks like
Yeah,
very
I want a good depressing porno for sure.
definitely a like a very hateful movie. Let's see here. Here's a question. No, actually, I'll ask that in a second. Okay, there are obviously a lot of rape revenge movies where dicks get destroyed, but usually that's mostly off screen or obscured. Can you talk about it in the masculine, like the conception of and making of the incredible genital gore?
Yeah, I can. We reshot the dick scenes like five different times because I just could not get it right. They make extremely realistic dildos that look awesome, but then when you cut into them, they're just like dense plastic. So I ended up getting sleeves and putting material in them and then hooking them up to my blood cannon. My blood cannon is it's just a bucket and a bilge pump, and it pumps an incredible amount of blood in a very short amount of time. But then that was kind of a challenge too, because the dicks would basically like blow up like a water balloon if we didn't already like cut into it. So that was a very hilarious afternoon of like trying to figure out how to pump the blood, show the first cut, and it was just a lot of trial and error until we finally got it. I'm still not 100% happy with how it looked, but after that final shoot, my dog ate all of the prop dicks. So we were done after that.
One
Because,
of the great credits in a movie is that part of the
yeah.
yeah.
Yeah,
Was that the dog I
that
saw
was a
earlier in the background?
ridiculous.
Is that the dog I saw earlier in the background?
Yeah, probably. He's around here somewhere. Yeah. Yeah, he's fine.
He's okay. The dog was fine. That's good to hear.
Yeah, thousands of dollars later, and being the butt of every joke at my work until the end of time, he's fine.
The poor doggy. Okay, and then specifically like the hot tub scene we were talking about earlier, like when he pulls out the pulls the dick balls and then all the intestines out of the tub, it looks so upsetting. And it's I know the water's helping you out there, but like can you talk about that bit in particular?
Yeah, those are just intestines from like China Mart. They just buy, you just get real intestines there. Finding a realistic black penis was nearly impossible. So that's why we kind of kept it submerged and under the bubbles, because it looked like a brown crayon. It just did not, we could not find it. We couldn't get it right. So a lot of the reason for the hot tub was like, how do we obscure this thing that just looks absolutely ridiculous? And I think the little flashes are okay. Also, the angling there didn't work quite like I wanted because, I mean, my actors didn't necessarily want to interact with, each other's junk and hands too much. So, like, the spacing's a little weird, which is why I have all the cutaways to, like, the blood just hitting the wall. And then the end, I just stopped at Asian Mart on the way and got, like, a $4 package of intestines. Luckily, we didn't get in trouble with that hotel. It was like some seedy motel, obviously, by the mirror on the wall and the jacuzzi in the room. But we tried to clean up pretty well, but I was expecting like a phone call or a bill or something. And apparently that just putting intestines in the hot tub there is just the norm. So
I'm
that's good.
sure. I bet worse things have been in the grimy motel
Oh, I
lobby.
am sure. Yeah.
Well, that scene, despite the problems you had with it, that scene looks amazing. And as I said,
Thank you.
just I keep flashing back to the intestines coming out of the water when I was pulling stills from the movie, and I was just going, kept going back to him, and be like, ah.
Yeah.
Okay, can you talk to me about you talked a little bit about kind of your previous movies you worked on. How do you feel you've evolved as a filmmaker since starting out as a teenager, it sounds like?
I think I get better with every movie, and hopefully that continues. Definitely adding the layer of glitching and video experimentation is something that is pretty interesting to me, and I want to keep growing. I just started dipping my toe in Kenneth Anger stuff a little bit.
Into
So
what,
I
sorry?
want to watch
Into what, sorry?
Kenneth Anger.
Kenneth Anger, cool, yeah.
And it's insane because just stuff's from like the 50s and 60s, and you're like, holy shit. So I want to pull a lot of that for my next movie with nightmare stuff and just really get abstract and make something visually interesting. But yeah, I think I've gotten more economical for sure. I probably spend 90% of my time shot listing, making sure it makes sense in my head, rehearsing like the order of operations and how I'm going to do things in my head. Where in the past I would like write the script, write a few notes, hope it went well. And I think what you learn is that everything seems really easy until you're all by yourself in a room full of friends, actors, and all of a sudden your brain just melts and you forget everything you know. You forget about angles and cuts and how you're supposed to move the camera, and you just become brain dead and freeze. And I think getting better at making movies is getting better at dealing with that and not absolutely panicking when that happens. That still happens to me. I hate it. I don't know if you know the feeling I'm talking about, but it's
Okay,
pretty
so
terrible where
yeah.
you're just like, I've never made a movie in my life. Where do I put this camera? How do I get this scene to work? How do I get this sequence? How do I show this movement?
Yeah, and you're
So
like,
learning how to harness that is what I keep gradually getting better at. And I think most of it goes into pre-production, like rehearsing and rehearsing and rehearsing, just like a musician would. Like by the time you get on stage and you're in front of a million people, if you've rehearsed the scene a million or rehearsed the piece a million times, it's probably going to go pretty okay despite, being nervous and whatever unexpected.
And do you feel like nervous when you're on set? Because it's like I'm assuming everyone's there basically for the love of the game, and it's like I know that when I've been on set in that situation, I feel like an extra pressure of like, if I fuck up, then I just wasted all their days, and they're being nice.
That and just like the what's gonna go wrong.
Yeah.
So like probably my most nervous weekend with the Emasculator was when we had everybody. Like Carly, who played Cindy, was she lives in Pennsylvania. She lives like 4 or 5 hours away. Adam lives a state away, so he was like three. So everybody needed to be there for that one specific weekend. And I absolutely did not ask for permission to use that racetrack whatsoever. So we just showed up and I'm like, are we going to get kicked off immediately? And I'm going to look like an asshole. And then we're going to have to like figure this out. Cause that's, I mean, it's a short scene, but that's a huge part of the story. And like people always don't show up. And it's like, if one person doesn't show up this week, and this is my first movie that like has more than one or two key characters, like all of these people need to be here. It's not like you can find some friend's girlfriend to get killed instead because someone didn't show up. Like these are all people throughout the story. So that may that those are the things that I get nervous about. And it turned out that it rained, so nobody was at the racetrack. We were able to just get into a bunch of places, like that school bus that we absolutely should not have been allowed to get to. We actually tried to go there for a separate scene a couple days later and immediately got kicked off.
Wow, so really lucky. Wow.
Really, really lucky. And somebody on a Letterboxd review recognized it, and I'm just like, keep it to yourself, person that lives in this town.
That's so wow, that's amazing. Because that whole sequence is so, yeah, I remember watching it being like, wow, great location. Hell yeah.
Yeah, and in a, in a hobby where everything that can go wrong will go wrong, we got insanely lucky.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. You mentioned him a few times, but shot on video legend Tim Ritter is credited as a producer and a writer, among other things, on this project. So can you talk about his involvement and your collaboration?
He's my boyfriend, so like we collaborate a lot. But we started just as two separate filmmakers. I reached out. Well, the legend is that we were both at a screening of Water Power, and we were sitting like same row but like different ends, and there was some dude in the middle, getting busy, and I peered over. I said, "Hey, are you Tim Ritter?" And he said, "Yeah." And we started talking about movies. Guy in the middle threw his hands up, said, "Nobody can get off to this," and stormed off. And then we sat together, started talking about movies, became friends, and things went from there. Realistically, I reached out for videotapes, mentioned that I was making a shot on video movie that was very much paying tribute to him and people like him. And then the bond just kind of grew and evolved from there. So
Well, both the legend and the true story are both very nice.
I like the legend better, but it's obviously, where are you? I was on one podcast where they didn't know what Water Power or Jamie Gillis was. And so they were like, "Oh, were you at a Jamie Gillis film festival?" And I was like, "Yes.
That's hell yeah.
Yes, I was.
The
A
legend.
Jamie Gillis film festival." Yep.
That would
It
be
could not
amazing.
have possibly been more over their heads. It was awesome.
Jamie Gillis film. Maybe you should start the Jamie Gillis film festival. I would go to that.
I would, you know what? I would go to that. Yeah.
He's
That would
amazing.
be
Yeah,
awesome.
it is. Oh, he gets. He, you give him a special. Do you give him a co-starring credit in The Emasculator? Is my brain telling me lies?
Yeah, I did like a featuring, or I worded it just like an honorary type deal. But yeah, Tim got that footage licensed for not a lot of money, and I was pretty excited to have that. I love, who doesn't love Jamie Gillis? He is such a personality, you know?
He's such a personality. Absolutely. Have you seen On the Prowl?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Again, that's another one that I really wish would get proper restoration because it looks terrible, but it's such a weird little universe to dive into.
Yeah,
And
absolutely.
I have Pure Filth, the Peter Sotos book. That's like,
Yeah.
yeah.
Okay, yeah, you're I also have that on my shelf. Yeah, very that book really broke me open, I think.
Before Tim and I started dating, when we were just like very platonic friends, for whatever reason, I would leave him voicemails, like reading stuff from that book,
That's
which, maybe we were probably already, on that path, because that's probably not something you should do with platonic guy friends. But that was absolutely one of my favorite things to do, was like run across a particularly sleazy like excerpt and then be like, "Oh yeah, I'm just gonna call Tim Ritter and leave him a voicemail with this."
That's so good. That's beautiful. You know, actually, me and my girlfriend, when we first started dating, we were both like pretty depressed when we first started hanging out, and we started bonding because I sent her some Peter Sotos books, and I was like, you gotta check out Index.
That's wild.
Yeah, just happened to be the right moment. We were both like, wow, everything is fucked up, and I feel fucked up and weird, and it's nice to meet another person who feels fucked
That's
up and weird.
beautiful, man. That's
Yeah,
perfect.
romance, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you and Tim were friends, and they eventually started dating. And like, so what's your collaboration process like?
It's weird. We're very different. I mean, we have the same sticky brain where we fixate on things in the same exact way and are very difficult to pull away from it, but he's the one that you would expect to be like old school analog, this is the way to do things, but he's like, "No, I'm tired of losing a million generations of quality while I edit. I'm tired of ruining houses and money with real blood." And so he's very modern in to an extent, in his way he goes about things. And I am very much like, "No, I want this soft, crappy camera from 1982 where you can barely see what's going on, and I want the comet tails from the tubes." And he's like, "These are the things that I was trying to avoid when I was doing this." And so, as far as process, we're a little bit different. But again, in like harnessing our obsessions into the projects we like, we're very similar. And what we kind of agreed is like, we're going to take charge on our individual projects and then just kind of take turns and support each other. Like, Tim got me out of a lot of tight spots in The Emasculator because he would run B camera on stuff that was like action packed or just had a lot going on. And I would say, "Fuck, I didn't get this shot." And then I would turn to Tim's footage and be like, "Oh, he got this shot." Or sometimes when I'm too short, he's just kind of like reaching it up and hand-holding it. Or again, he's the stronger writer. So absolutely, I will show him what I'm writing and he'll say, "Well, why don't you do this, that, or the other thing?" I don't know that the guys in The Emasculator were initially going to be porn filmmakers. I don't remember because it changed so many times, but I think that was his idea too. So a lot of the writing was Tim. And when Tim does his projects, I already told him, I would like to do a lot of the shooting and I would like to do a lot of the blood cannoning. No more CGI blood.
We
We're
get
not doing that.
hell yeah, get the real blood back in there.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Great, thank you. The great answer. Okay, we're screening The Emasculator at an underground film festival. Do you consider yourself an underground filmmaker, and what does that mean to you, if so?
It makes me think of Your Next, where he's like, underground? What, you're like showing these movies underground, like in basements, and he's just being a real dickwad. I don't know. I don't take myself all that. It's funny because I take it really seriously, but I don't take myself all that seriously. Like, it's a very obsessive hobby for me. Like, I was at work with a client and she said, she looked at my necklace, which is like a little camera, and she said, oh, are you a director? And it took me a solid 30 seconds to be like, oh yeah, I make movies. Oh yes, I'm a director. So I don't know. I'm not. It's so embedded into like what I have to do and who I am that I don't really consider myself like a filmmaker or underground or whatever. It's just my hobby that I care a lot about, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Okay. Next question is, other than Tim, are there any other filmmakers working right now whose work you really connect with?
Working right now. I mean, I like all the other people that are doing the shot on video stuff. I think it's cool to see how everyone has the same medium, but does it so differently and like puts their own twist into it. Maddie Deering, who did Spirit Animal and Bathtub Shark Attack, she and I get along really well. And she actually helped with The Emasculator. The scene where Cindy kills herself and like the flashlight, we're doing like a psycho thing with the light bulb. That was 100% Maddie with like a bounce card. So I really like her stuff, and it's not necessarily like it's very trauma-y, very fun, and it's not necessarily my thing, but it's absolutely, you know, who she is, which again, I think it's cool. Same medium, completely different thing. Or like Bruce Longo's got that whole like Philly, like punk metal thing going on, and you can absolutely see like a little slice of his life when you watch his movies. Same with Casper Meldahare and all the wild and woolly stuff that she's doing. So while those, while they're not necessarily like, oh my God, my favorite filmmakers, you know, it's also like cool to see again real people making movies as opposed to directors and producers to kind of see like little mini self-portraits of these guys when they put out projects. So I dig that for sure.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Okay. Wrapping up here. Any questions that you wish I'd asked you, but I haven't?
No, I think that was pretty good. I think you just about covered everything. My brain's admittedly a little melted from a long work week, but I think we did all right.
Think we do. You've said lots of fantastic stuff.
Yeah, sorry I talked real fast. I get excited and you know, I just kind of word vomit things that I like, so.
No need to apologize, especially to me. I talk very fast as well, and also you talked a fine rate, if I may say. All right, what's what my last question before we wrap up, and then I'll let you go, is what's next? Are you working on something coming up? Do you have something in the works?
Yeah, and this is a very personal project, and I'm going to get into some personal stuff, but not like feel bad for me personal, just for context. So, you know, I started with Johnny Braineater, Metal Maniac, which were, you know, mini DV shot on video stuff. And then I got into the digital DSLR snooty realm because I was kind of peer pressured into it. So while I was doing that, I was probably, and that's the big gap of like not putting out a lot of stuff. While I was doing that, my mom got really sick and she died like a pretty brutal cancery death. And I was like, this was like probably 10 years ago. So I was pretty upset and I started making a movie called The Stepkid that is very autobiographical. But it's like a weird mishmash of it. A kid loses their dad that they were extremely close to cancer, and they're having these insane nightmares because like when you're a kid and you watch your parent get sick, it just feels wrong and scary and weird because they're, you know, the one that's supposed to be taking care of you. And watching a parent get super sick is just quite the horrific, gory event that I don't think movies do right. So anyways, this kid is having all of these insane nightmares of his dad in like the radiation cancer mask with all these IV lines and vomiting and bleeding and all of this stuff. And the way he deals with it is watching horror movies and like escaping into his fantasy land, but that only makes the nightmares worse. The way the mom is dealing with the grief of like dealing with all of that is bringing home men that exploit her. And the kid is seeing this and she's putting all of her attention into these men and not the kid. And so it's kind of like two people that very much need each other but are escaping into their own world rather than helping each other. And so obviously it turns into the kid finding that he can kind of get attention from his mom if he kills the men that she brings home, and her self-esteem just like goes more and more and more out the window as she thinks these men are leaving her. So she brings home scummier and worse men, and it's just all going to snowball out of control. So when I first tried it, that's where you would have asked me if I was an underground filmmaker, and I would have been like, yes, I am a filmmaker. I have a light meter and a DSLR camera and a light kit, and I'm going to be the next Martin Scorsese. And it was a really stupid fucking way to make movies. And what happened was I did take it very seriously, and I intimidated the hell out of my actors, who again were just people. It was Brad G. Grinter's teenage daughter and like some lady from work, not actors. And I'm like, read my dialogue, it's perfect. And like using a light meter in front of like people, they're terrified. They're like, what is this? Oh my God, this is a real movie. They're freaking out. And so I made it, and it looked really good, but there was no feeling, there was no heart to it. It was like, this is my childhood of like losing a dad and having a mom bring home all of these dudes because she's all messed up and like having to deal with that. Like, this should be a super awesome personal movie, and it just feels like nothing. So that's the next project. Tim's going to help me. We're going to make it a little less personal. He's going to add a little bit of the Ritter sleaze. We were thinking the mom gets more and more into like wild S&M stuff with these guys. The kid sees it, thinks his mom is being hurt, and then it ties into his nightmares. So we're writing that right now. I just bought a house, so like now I actually have a place where I can shoot this. This is going to be the stepkid's room, which I think is pretty like perfect for like 90s horror kid.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I'm thinking it's going to go a lot better, A, with like really wild video experiment nightmares, and B, just that shot on video, like I am just doing this with friends. I'm taking it seriously, but not myself seriously. Mentality, letting people improvise and have fun. I think it's going to work a lot better that way. And it's still going to be cathartic for me because sure, there's some stuff that like I want to get out of my system and talk about. And let's face it, like in this country, the divorce rate's like greater than 60%. So most people that watch this are absolutely going to be like, yeah, my mom brought home all of these just scumbag dudes, and I would have loved to watch them all get murdered. Maybe not to that, but like it's not a particularly unique situation, and it's extremely relatable. So I think it's going to be a really cool movie.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be an awesome movie. Did
Yeah, I
you?
hope I mean, like I said, I think I can pull it off now with like VHS and video glitches and a better mentality than I had back in the stupid digital days.
When you shot the original version, how long was that project?
So it was weird. It took us so long to shoot because Brad Grinter only had his daughter on particular weekends, and it was someone from work, and we had crazy. So like we shot kind of when we could. And then the daughter like hit puberty and looked completely different in like a split second. So we kind of cut it together with what we had. It was like 40 minutes of just pretty looking impossible to hear nonsense bullshit. It was terrible. It was really, really bad.
Really
The
bad.
nightmares were cool. We shot the nightmares on Kodak Double X.
Oh, okay.
And we shot them in my backyard, and they're super high contrasty and dark and terrifying looking. Those were awesome. Everything else in the movie was terrible.
There's a chance that any of those nightmare sequences will show up in the new version?
Probably, yeah. Some of them have like the girl that we were using, who is now like a grown woman, but there's definitely stuff that I can cut in. I mean, I have to use that stuff. It's the only time I've ever shot 16 millimeter, and it was awesome. Like it was so fun, and we might shoot 16 again at some point, just probably black and white again, because I can hand develop it, and it's the most affordable way. But now that I have like a house and a basement, maybe we'll shoot a little bit of film again too.
Hell yeah. Well, I'm really excited for your future, this project coming up. I'm really excited to hear it. Hopefully you can play with some 16 mil. I'm just delighted to see what you come up with next. Thanks so much for talking to me,
Yeah,
and
thanks for having me. It was awesome talking to you.